So tonight I wanted to speak with you about our relationship to the different ideas and concepts that we come across in this tradition of Buddhism. You know, I think this is especially important right now. You might notice, especially in the Vipassana tradition in the United States, have you noticed when you pick up a book on Vipassana meditation that there's these references to all these different kinds of traditions, right? It's not only Theravada Buddhism that's being referenced, but there's other schools of Buddhism that are being referenced. And not only other schools of Buddhism that are being referenced, but of these other spiritual traditions. So what we find is this mixture, this amalgam of all these different teachings coming together as we're learning this path. And I think as a result, it's really a rich time for Buddhist practice in the States because of that. But not only is it a rich time, but it's also a very tricky time. I think there can be a lot of detours and a lot of misunderstanding as a result of this. So how do we navigate this? How do we navigate all these ideas and concepts in Buddhism? And I'm sure all of you here, right, have been exposed to many teachings other than just the Theravada teachings when you've come across meditation. And you might even, when you've explored meditation, many of you might not even keep your exploration to just a strict Theravada perspective. Right? So it's the environment that we find ourselves in. And not only that, not only do we have these different ideas from these different schools of Buddhism seeping into this path and the way it's talked about, but also these ideas that come from psychology are beginning to seep into it. And that's something that I hope if some of you saw the article that was posted on the website, this is going to be something that we're going to be talking tomorrow night at Joni's house, is what's the difference, to really get clear about what the difference is between Buddhism and psychotherapy. Where do they meet and how are they different? So that we can move forward on this path with clarity. So yeah, what's our relationship to this tradition that we call Buddhism, and especially to this emerging flavor of this tradition, this mixture? And in a broader context, what's our relationship to any spiritual tradition? How do you relate to that? How do you digest those views, those ideas, those concepts that you come across? And the first thing that I'd like to begin with is actually something that I shared with you the last time I was here. And that's this passage from the Zen Master Dogen that really talks about views. Because I think when we begin to explore how to utilize these ideas and concepts, these quote-unquote stories of Buddhism, what we need to keep in mind is, what's our relationship to views in our life? Because you might have noticed that your mind is like my mind, and what happens is that we get stuck in a certain view, and then there's this feeling that my view is right and all the other views are wrong. Have you ever noticed that? All too common. And so that's why I find this passage that I read last time from Dogen so striking, because it really shows that as we deepen our practice, there's a different relationship to views, which is going to influence our relationship to any spiritual tradition. So he begins, and this is from something called the Genjo Koan. He says, "When Dharma does not fill your whole body and mind, you think it is already sufficient. When Dharma fills your body and mind, you understand that something is missing." So I just want to point out here, as I did last time, we usually conceptualize this differently. So when the Dharma doesn't fill our whole body and mind, we would think our understanding would be that something's missing. But he's saying the opposite. He's saying that when you're not completely filled with the Dharma, you think that it's already sufficient. So you're deluded, thinking that it's already sufficient. Yet when there is deep understanding of the Dharma, there's always an understanding that something is missing, in particular from your viewpoint. That's what we gain from the Dharma, is seeing that there's always something missing from whatever viewpoint that we have. And he gives an example. For example, when you sail out in a boat to the middle of an ocean where no land is in sight, and view the four directions, the ocean looks circular, and it does not look any other way. But the ocean is neither round nor square. Its features are infinite in variety. It is like a palace. It is like a jewel. It only looks circular as far as you can see at that time. All things are like this. So again, do you hear this example? When we're out in the boat, the ocean looks circular, but that's just one viewpoint. And there's something missing from that viewpoint because there's different views of what the ocean looks like. And then he goes on, though there are many features in the dusty world and the world beyond conditions, you see and understand only what your eye of practice can reach. In order to learn the nature of the myriad things, you must know that although they may look round or square, the other features of oceans and mountains are infinite in variety. Whole worlds are there. It is so not only around you, but also directly beneath your feet, or in a drop of water. So, what is he trying to convey here? Mainly, the more deeply we go into this practice of the Dharma, the more that we see that any view that we take is going to be limited, because there is infinite amounts of views. So what's it like? What's it like to relate to a tradition or the ideas and concepts in a tradition with this sense? That even those ideas and concepts in Buddhism, even those stories, are always going to be limited. So how do we navigate them? How do we make use of them, knowing that they're limited? And the sense I get from the way that Dogen's talking about it is that when we really know this, then we can start to have a fluid relationship to the viewpoints that we come across, rather than this is the way it is, and making sure that we're sensitive to that. So, you know, my intention tonight with this talk is to provide kind of a feeling of relating to the spiritual path differently. A feeling of having a fluid relationship to the spiritual path, to the stories and ideas that we find in it, rather than this is the way it is. And so cultivating this relationship of this tradition being more of a story than a doctrine. But what's important is that it's a story that we need to fully engage in. So fully engaging in a story or an idea without getting attached to it. And so what I'm going to share with you tonight is a number of quote-unquote stories or ideas that we find in Buddhism that sound contradictory, and to see if we can get a sense or a feeling of them allowing them to be contradictory, yet at the same time allowing ourselves to get a sense of what it's like to fully engage in them at the same time. So let me give you just an example of this just from my own practice. I went a number of times to Nepal to do these longer retreats. And so usually a few days before the retreat and a few days after, I'd have some time in Kathmandu. And for any of you who've been to Kathmandu, you know there's these two stupas there, at Swayambhunath Stupa, and then at Bodhnath. And when I was there, in the evenings, I would go to these stupas, and I would really engage and take on this belief that those stupas were an extremely holy place, and that it would be more auspicious for me to do my walking meditation circumambulating these stupas rather than just anywhere else. And I fully engaged in that belief. I believed it. I really let it affect me. And at the same time, you know, when I come back here and I'm in the States, I also at times have this feeling that any place that I find myself is just as holy as any other place. But being at the gas station, I can cultivate mindfulness in a way, and that gas station is just as holy as that stupa. So then I take on a different belief. I take on a different story. And I found that that process is something that really helps deepen this practice. Does that make sense? So I want to give some examples of this, and to also notice, and these examples are important because within Buddhism, around some of these examples, there's been much discussion about what the Buddha actually taught. There's endless arguments and discussions about what the Buddha actually taught. And some people say, no, this is the way it is, and that idea actually is not in Buddhism, and it doesn't lead to awakening. Oh, and then the opposite argument. And I feel that there's a way of getting lost in those arguments where we just start to think about the practice rather than fully engage in it. So let's see if we can navigate some of these stories and to see if we can allow them to be contradictory, but to fully engage in them as well. I also want to point out, though, that when we begin to navigate this spiritual tradition or any spiritual tradition, we need to make sure that we don't get lost in taking on an idea or a concept just because we like it, and we leave aside another idea or concept just because we don't like it. Right? Many of you probably noticed, and sometimes this is why we come to the practice, when we live our lives based on merely what we like and don't like, our lives end up being not very fruitful. Have you noticed that? When we just get batted around by likes and dislikes, there's not going to be depth to our lives and to our spiritual practice. So it's the same with these ideas and concepts. Can we see which ones really fit for us? Not based on what we like and dislike, but what's going to be useful. What can we utilize in this stage of our practice, wherever that is, or whatever day it is? So one of the stories that we come across in Buddhism, also in early Buddhism, is the story that I can wake up, that this is a path of cultivation in which through my own efforts I can come to awakening. And the Buddha, there's one passage where he's speaking about this which I find very striking. It's a very famous passage, and it's a passage that takes place near the end of the Buddha's life. So let me set the setting for you. What was going on is the Buddha had gotten sick, and he's near dying. And Ananda's getting pretty worried about it. Right? He's quite upset about it, and he's worried that the Dharma is going to disappear and the community is going to disappear when the Buddha disappears. And it's pretty visceral. He explains that Ananda says, "When I saw the Blessed One's sickness, it was as though my own body became weak as a creeper. Everything around became dim to me, and my senses failed me." Right? It's in a bad state. So the Buddha addresses him. And this is the advice that he gives to Ananda, the explanation. He says, "Therefore, Ananda, be islands unto yourselves, refuges unto yourselves, seeking no external refuge. With the Dharma as your island, the Dharma as your refuge, seeking no other refuge." I find that such striking advice to give, to be an island unto yourself. And I want to point out how radical this was, especially for that culture. It was a quote-unquote, if you've read the article that was on the website, it was a membership culture. So in the Buddha's time, that culture, there was more emphasis on what was valued more was the community over the individual. Right? So this is extremely radical for that. He's saying, actually, don't value the community. Value yourself. That you have to be a refuge for yourself, an island unto yourself. So have a sense of yourself. Have a sense of yourself as an island. And it's not only radical for that culture, but I think it's radical for this culture. You might notice how so much of the time what we rely upon is we relying upon a book or another person or a deity or the internet and not on ourselves for where we're getting our wisdom, where we're trying to get the knowledge or trying to get understanding. And he's saying something very different. Right? An island unto yourself. And then the Buddha goes on. He goes on and really clearly explains what he means by this. So he says, "And how Ananda is a practitioner, an island unto themselves, a refuge unto themselves, seeking no external refuge, with the Dharma as their island, the Dharma as their refuge, seeking no other refuge." And this is what the Buddha, how he answers. He says, "When the practitioner dwells contemplating the body in the body, earnestly, clearly comprehending and mindfully, and after having overcome desire and sorrow in regard to the world, when he dwells contemplating feelings and feelings, the mind and the mind, and mental objects and mental objects." So what has the Buddha just described right there? Thank you. Yeah, right? The four foundations of mindfulness. So that's what it is to seek refuge in ourselves. He's very specific. It's seeking refuge in our ability to go within, our ability to go inward. That's what we're seeking refuge in. And again, what a radical thing. Especially even in this culture, what a radical thing. It's not a common thing to be taught how to go inward. And not only how to go inward, but to begin to rely upon that. So again, the story that I can awaken by cultivating mindfulness, by seeking support. Where do I seek support? By my sense of the self as an island. An island that is really cultivated through mindfulness. I can awaken through my own efforts. And not only a sense of myself as an island, another story that we're exposed to, or another idea that we're exposed to in Buddhism, is that a sense of myself as worthy of waking up, as worthy of some taste of liberation, of some taste of the heart being free. And this is so important for this culture, because we can have so much of a sense of unworthiness, that I'm not worthy for this. And the Buddha is really recommending to get a sense of worthiness. And it's interesting how he recommends cultivating this. There's a story of Ananda teaching a nun about the practice, and he's talking about how we should cultivate the sense of when we see someone else progress on the path, when we see someone else, maybe you see somebody like the Dalai Lama, or another practitioner, or a monastic, and you see how their lives are changed, or how they walk in the world differently, to have the sense when you see a person like that, if they can change, or they can wake up, I can too. One of the images that's given, and I think it's the teachings around King Melinda, is it's as if there's all these people on one side of the bank of a river, and it's this flooding river, and everybody's standing there, and then eventually one person decides to swim across the river and gets to the other side of the bank. And having everyone else witness that, everyone else starts to gain the confidence that, oh, if that person can do it, I can do it too. And then more people go, and then those people on the bank can gain more confidence, and then they eventually go. So a sense of myself that I am enough. I have this possibility to wake up. And I want to point out something about this sense of if that person can do it, I can do it. That's actually a form of conceit in Buddhist terms. So conceit in Buddhist terms is whenever it's the comparing mind. I'm sure most of you probably experienced that. Oh, I'm better than that person. I'm not at all as worthy as that person. I'm equal to that person. It's conceit because we're resting in a sense of self. A sense of self that's either better than, worse than, or equal to another person. And the Buddha's saying, the one sense of conceit that you want to engage in is, if they can do it, I can do it. So the phrase that's used is, it's the way of utilizing conceit to go beyond conceit. So we take up a sense of self in order to go beyond the self. So again, a sense of myself is worthy. Another story that we're encouraged to take up. And to notice, even then, that's a story that we want to go beyond or want to let go of. But we need to fully engage in it before we let go of it. I want to share with you a story that comes from later on in Buddhism. Not in early Buddhism, not in Theravada Buddhism. But again, also gives this sense of, I am worthy to wake up. But a different sense, which I think is important. And I want to share with you a story about this. And the story comes from the Lotus Sutra. And it's one of the parables in that. And the story goes that once upon a time, there was a father and a son. And at a very young age, the son was separated from his father and was, for the next 10 or 20 years, living in other countries. In a very difficult life. He was traveling around, trying to find places just to get food and clothing and shelter. So for 10, 20 years, traveling around. And then, unbeknownst to him, he ended up in the country of his father once again. And his father was this nobleman. So he ends up in this country, not knowing it's the country of his father. And he happens upon the gates of his father's palace, and is looking through the gates. And his father sees him and recognizes him as his son and starts walking towards him. But for the son is shocked and extremely frightened to have someone of such nobility walking towards him. Because he doesn't see himself that way, right? He sees himself as just somebody getting by, as someone that is unworthy. And so he runs away in fear. And the father, desperately wanting his son, sends a messenger out towards him. And the messenger catches up to him and tries to bring him back to his father. And he's so afraid that he faints. So just right here in the story, what do we have going on right here? We have this son that is forgotten. He cannot remember what his true home is. He doesn't really know where he truly belongs. He can't remember who his father is. He has forgotten the riches that are really due to him. He only sees himself as someone that is unworthy. He can't handle it. Just the sight of his father is overwhelming to him. So the story goes on. And then the father, being a wise father, devises a plan to send out some messengers and tell the son, or to offer him 2 days wages for 1 day of labor if he comes back and just moves some dirt on the father's property. So the son comes back and he begins to work there as a laborer. And the king, instead of wearing the garment of this noble person, instead puts on rags or the clothes of a laborer and starts to relate to his son just on a daily basis. And over the years, over 10 or 20 years, they begin to have this relationship or cultivate this relationship, trust and safety, where the son gradually starts to feel okay with his father. And then one day, after many years, the father comes and has a grave illness and is close to death. And so he gathers everyone around, and with everyone around, he announces to everyone and to the son, "This is my son. This is my long-lost son that is actually the heir to all my riches." And it is at that point that the son has the capacity to see that, oh, this is my true home. This is the real family that I belong to. This is where I'm supposed to rest. And then from there, the son is able to take on that role and to take care of the people underneath him in an appropriate way. So this story, or this parable, was shared in the Lotus Sutra as an analogy to Buddha nature. So that we are all these lost sons that have actually forgotten where our true home is. Don't know how to really rest in wakefulness. And we rest in wakefulness, we get a little scared. And it's too much. We don't have the capacity for it. But gradually, with practice, we gain the capacity to rest in this new home. so that eventually we can rest in our own Buddha nature. So another story that I am worthy of awakening, but it's different than the story I told you before, because this story is not about cultivation. I mean, in some ways, we take on the guise or the illusion that we're cultivating something. But deep down inside, we don't have to cultivate anything. We just need to recognize that our true home is wakefulness itself. And what the problem is a lack of capacity, not a lack of ability or a lack of skill. It's a different story. And I find that that story sometimes can be a useful story, because so many times in practice, have you noticed that sometimes we can engage in practice as a way of becoming somebody. I need to become somebody better than I am right now, so why don't I engage in meditation? And then meditation becomes a setup for just following an old pattern of not being able to completely accept ourselves the way we are. So a useful story at times. And maybe the story of cultivation is useful at times. Again, different stories. But then we also come to recognize there's a different story that we come across in Buddhism as well that I feel is important. And that's the story of, I can't awaken. And there's some real truth to this, which is important. And some of you might have noticed this, for example, and let me explain this a little bit more clearly, but you might have noticed, this can especially happen if you've been on maybe like your first longer retreat. You know, you have the intention to make your mind calm and clear, and you're going to become enlightened in a week and all this great stuff. And then you sit down on the cushion for a few days, and you realize how crazy that mind is that you're carrying around. Have you ever noticed that? Wow. And there's a realization that what we've come to identify, all those thoughts, feelings, and emotions, those things that we've categorized as ourself will never wake up. That sense of I doesn't wake up. But when we start to see that sense of I, there can be an awakening that begins to arise. I can't awaken. That sense of I cannot awaken. Another story. This is from a brand of Buddhism that we don't hear much about, at least in the States. It's more common in Japan, Shin Buddhism, or Pure Land Buddhism, or Jodo Shinshu. In Shin Buddhism, they have this, I just love this idea. It's the idea that on the path to realization, one of the first steps that we need to come to is that I am a foolish being. And the way I translate it into our practice is noticing, is what we come to notice is that we can allow the mind to be as crazy as it wants to be because it's no longer me or mine. Right? It's just this foolish thing that pumps out thoughts. And it can be such a relief not to identify with that anymore. Such a relief to see that that's just the activity of a foolish being. Phew. And it's not me. This is important, especially if we really engage in spiritual practice, we can really start to take ourselves quite seriously. And then what we've done is we start to take a self, quite seriously. For me, it's always led to disaster. I don't know about you, it doesn't work. Especially when it gets imbued into my spiritual practice. Yeah. So this sense of I can't awaken, this foolish being. So what also, another idea that comes with this realization of a foolish being in Shin Buddhism is that this sense of I cannot awaken by my own efforts. So Shinran, one of the founders of Shin Buddhism, realized I can practice as hard as I want for endless lifetimes, and my own efforts will never lead to awakening. Do you hear that this is different from the story I told at the beginning? And I'm not saying one is better than the other, it's just a different view of the ocean. My own efforts will not lead to awakening. And it is only by giving myself over to rather than investing all my efforts into self-power, investing myself or trusting what is translated as other power, which is really having faith in Amida Butsu or Amida Buddha. Having faith in Amida Buddha, in other power, will allow this mind to wake up. I know it's starting to sound kind of like Christianity, so I want to make some distinctions here. Everybody's getting a little worried out there. I can feel it. I think there's something to this other power, though. And I want to give some ways of making bridges where we can possibly relate to this inner practice in a way which I find important and can be very skillful for a practice. So I want to point out that this other power is quite different in Shin Buddhism. For example, there's one Shin Buddhist teacher that says, the voice with which I call Amida Buddha is the voice with which Amida Buddha calls to me. Right? So there's no difference between myself and other power. Or in other words, on a deeper level, it becomes that we begin to see that self-power or own efforts are no other than other power. But there's something important about this sense of other power. So I want to talk about that just in terms of our own practice and how we sometimes can get a sense of this. You might have noticed, for some of you who've had this sense in your meditation, sometimes we can have a sense in our meditation or we drop to a place, even a sense of sometimes when we get a sense of not-self, this visceral experience of not-self, or when we sink into our meditation, sometimes there's this sense that we're resting in a place that somehow, for lack of a better word, bigger than me. It's bigger than my sense of self. It's somehow greater or beyond that. Have you ever gotten a taste of that? And in some ways, that can be really similar to the sense of other power, in the sense of it allows us to get rid of this self-centric view of our practice and our lives. And I have found that to be so important for my practice. Because if my practice is only about me, then my practice is extremely limited. And if I'm only relying on myself, practice isn't going to get very far. And at times you might notice, like for example, the sense of mindfulness or the sense of loving kindness or compassion or sympathetic joy or equanimity, that sometimes we can get a taste of that where we get a feeling that it's actually not coming from us. Rather, that mindfulness is something that we rest in. Especially with loving kindness. I've noticed that many times people get this first taste with loving kindness, that it's not something that I'm generating, rather it's something that I'm letting go into, that is much bigger than my sense of self. So again, the story of something bigger than ourselves can be useful. It can be skillfully used. Not in a dogmatic way, but yet just in another story to take up. Another way that I found it useful, actually later on in my practice, is remembering that we're actually social creatures. We're relational creatures. So sometimes utilizing that aspect of being a human being, a relational human being, can be really helpful for our practice. So for example, last week, my fiancé and I moved into this house. It's a very Buddhist house. It's marked by impermanence. It's really falling apart. Usually I love the rain and Flagstaff, but now whenever it rains, we have some serious problems with the roof. Not only the roof, but... So we move into this house, and right when we got the keys, the first thing that I did, that we decided to do, and since I got the keys, this is what I did, is I went into the house, and what I did... to really honor a different kind of intention around the house is I did this chant to this bodhisattva in the Tibetan tradition, Vajrasattva, and just walking around the house of doing this chant while I was clarifying the kind of intention that we wanted to place for this home. And when I did that, again, I was really engaging in that belief that there was this other power that I was calling upon to help support me in this intention. And I found that so important for me to do, to really call upon a power that was outside of myself, especially around a house. Because I've noticed in this culture that there can be so much identification around a house, that a house is about me and it's about us. It's about our values. And I wasn't interested, you weren't interested in living in a house like that. And so it was wonderful to engage in a ritual that I was calling upon something that wasn't about me and it wasn't about us. It was about this bodhisattva ideal. And what it allowed me was not to only have the idea of it in my head, but to have my heart be moved in some way and to bring that into the house. So there can be something very powerful about calling on an other power. But again, holding that in a way that it's not about figuring out if that other being exists or doesn't exist, or what I believe in or what I don't believe in. Because when I get lost in those arguments, then I'm limiting the kinds of views of a spiritual practice that I can utilize. So may all of us gain the skill of really being able to fully engage in whatever story is necessary for our spiritual path, and also being able to let go of those, really for the liberation of all beings. Thank you.